Hi everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. It's a very special 50th episode for this current podcast, and to join me for that is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
I'm as surprised as you are that we made 50 episodes, Andrew. Are you?
It's taken us a while. We're doing this 2.5 years now, but delighted to make 50 episodes. It's a bit of a milestone.
As a special for this episode, we'll have an interview with former ICD President Easton Manny. Before we get to that, we're going to cover a couple of matches that have been on the last couple of weeks. And the first of those was the Netherlands versus Papua New Guinea I-Cup game. We'd indicated, I think, in our preview that Papua New Guinea might struggle, and they certainly did in the first innings. They were bowled out for 128 to Netherlands' 209, although they did pretty well with the ball. But they made a remarkable chase of 305, only losing 5 wickets on the final day.
Yeah, well, on the third day, obviously, they won with one day to spare. A quite remarkable performance, really, there from Papua New Guinea. Asad Vala, on first-class debut, scoring an unbeaten 124. Mahuru Dai just fell short of his century, scored 91. And, the pair put on, I think, exactly 200. And a superb partnership there. And, once those two got settled, you couldn't see anything other than a Papua New Guinea win.
Some outstanding performances in this game. Lowe New in the first innings took 5 for 49. Tim Vandergooden, 6 for 29 off 17 overs, and just ripped through Papua New Guinea in the first innings. Is it something of a surprise?
Yeah, and he bowled 10 maidens as well, which is quite a phenomenal display, really.
It's a sort of surprise that he didn't in the second innings, but Papua New Guinea, as well as scoring 305, they did it at almost 4 runs and overs, and Legacy Arca opened up. He was out in the last ball of the second day, unfortunately, but at that point he'd scored 49 off 37 balls, which it really must have tipped the balance a little bit in terms of getting that chase underway and giving them the momentum.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly know Legacy Acker is capable of scoring very quickly when he gets in, and that gave Papua New Guinea a very good platform and gave him a bit of a boost ahead of that third day.
Looking at the Netherlands, there's a lot of starts there in their scores, and no one really going on. That really was what cost them.
Yeah, I think the problem was with a lot of it was with the upper order. You see, in the first innings, the top scorers are Seeler and Van Meekeren at numbers 7 and 9. And then again in the second innings, the top scorer is Tim Vandergooten with 57, batting at 8. And when you're having to rely on that lower order to get you back in, you're going to struggle. And at one point in that second innings, they were 17 for 3, and Papua New Guinea were bowling very well, and it took that lower order to come back in. And when your top order fails, you shouldn't be having it. It's always tricky to get a big score. I had Swart, Myberg, O'Dowd, the debutant, and Boran stayed in for a while, you could have seen Netherlands put on a score that would have put the game out of Papua New Guinea's reach, but instead, because of that top order struggling, I think that's why Papua New Guinea won in the end.
So they've won their first I-Cup game, they also won their first ODI match against Hong Kong a while back, so Papua New Guinea continue to make these firsts, and they're really going to earn themselves a reputation, and it's great preparation for the World 2020 qualifiers that they're in such good form.
Oh, certainly. Obviously, it's a different format, but any preparation is good preparation, and especially if you get into a winning mood, then you're going to take that confidence into a tournament and perhaps look to qualify. It's a shame that they won't have Geraint Jones available for those 2020 qualifiers. It seems he's too busy with Gloucestershire, unfortunately. So much for the mandatory release rules, but they're short in this game that they don't necessarily need him.
And there was also a couple of T20 internationals between Ireland and Scotland. As is traditional, the second one was washed out. But the first one, Scotland showed that, again, they actually are really the form team of Associate Cricket at the moment. Ireland, their bowling, again, let them down a little bit. They couldn't defend 146, and Scotland got there with 4 wickets down.
I think you're seeing now the impact of the retirement of Tim Murtagh from T20 cricket internationally is having on Ireland. Obviously, he's a very very useful 2020 bowler for Middlesex in county cricket, and you know, has been for Ireland in the past. And now we're seeing, you know, we don't really have that anymore. I think Ireland, to some extent, have fallen behind in 2020 cricket. You know, I know they had a slightly weakened side in this. You know, they were missing, you know, most of the county players. But still a very below par performance. You know, 146 for 5 isn't really enough in 2020 cricket these days. And, you know, that was just short. You know, Scotland chased that down with 4 overs to spare. You know, cross scored 60 from 34 balls. And, you know, Tyrone Cain, you know, made a sort of bit of a splash on debut. He took 3 wickets in 1 over. But aside from that, there really wasn't anything to write home about for Ireland. So obviously there was supposed to be a second 2020 international on Friday, which got washed out, and then in the remarkable display of common sense that's not usually apparent in cricket administration, they decided to reschedule that for Saturday afternoon, which is the day we are recording this podcast, and then they'll play the third one as scheduled on Sunday, and you know, it's good, you know, obviously. This is at the Ireland's new ground in Breedy, or newly approved ground in Breedy, should I say. So it's good that the crowd that's come out to watch it in the northwest of Ireland. It's the first time Ireland have played there, I think, since 2004. So they've been a bit starved of international cricket up there, and it's good that we've rescheduled this match to give that crowd something to come and watch.
Yeah, absolutely, and we'll cover those matches when we do our preview for that tournament next week. We're joined now on the podcast by someone who has long championed the cause of global development and better governance as a representative of the Pakistan Cricket Board at the ICC and as the ICC president, and most recently as a vocal opponent of the Big Three governance reforms. And we have a very warm welcome to Eason Manning. Hi, Eason.
Good morning.
Let's begin with some development issues. When you were involved with the ICC, it coincided with a period in which the World Cup was successfully expanded and the I-Cup and World Cricket League was introduced. Looking back, there seemed to be a lot of optimism around associate cricket then that there doesn't seem to have been since. But what do you suppose that is?
Look, it's unfortunate that money has taken precedence over the game in recent years. Our thrust was twofold. First, to get as many countries playing cricket as possible. As the leading and the governing body of sport, that was one of ICC's mandates. And secondly, once they were playing, is to improve the quality of their play. It was a two-pronged approach. Now what we are finding are ICC stepping back, saying that they're not really concerned with many countries who don't play a high standard of cricket. It's how much money are they prepared to spend on it. The unfortunate thing is that ICC has substantially more money today than they've ever had. But instead of putting it in the development of the game and in the long term, for the long term benefit of the game as a whole, this money is being diverted to a number of full member countries.
And from that period, did the Associate Nations achieve what you thought they'd achieve when that was ongoing?
There were certainly, you know, when you look at the number of countries that started playing cricket, and you can see what's happened between then and today. I'm talking about 2006 when I left as president of ICC. By then, thanks mainly to the efforts of Mr. Dalmia from India and Malcolm Gray from Australia, a lot more members had joined in our presidencies than had ever joined as members of the ICC. Since then, it's been stagnant. We'd identified certain countries as with a huge amount of potential, China being one of them, United States certainly being right up there in front as another, and Afghanistan as the third. And only one of them, which is Afghanistan, has really sort of come through. More out of their own endeavours than anything that the ICC has done for them.
And in terms of performance, there was a kind of an idea that the associates didn't achieve at the World Cup, and that was one of the reasons why it's been reduced since then. Is that something you think is a valid reason?
No, I don't think so. You know, it takes a long time for countries. First of all, to be able to play at the highest level, you have to have exposure against countries at the highest levels. There's no point of bringing these countries into world events when you don't play with them outside the world events. You know, like soccer, for example, has qualifying rounds around the world, so every country gets to play against a much better quality team than themselves, especially the emerging nations. So the associates have been left a lot to their own devices to try and improve their game, which is always going to be tough for them. But in spite of that, there was some very good cricket played by the associate member countries in the recent World Cup. Ireland did very well. Afghanistan did well. UAE did well. The potential is there. It's a matter of capturing it and making sure that it improves. I mean, it took New Zealand 26 years to win its first test match because the transformation from into international cricket and test cricket in particular is a very tough one.
Yeah, Isan mentioned early on about ICC being a governing body, and there's been a lot recently about ICC perhaps being seen more as a members organisation for the benefit of the full members. Was it always that case in the past, or was it more seen as a governing body in the past?
Look, till 1993, it was very much a social club. The ICC used to meet once a year at Lord's. The MCC provided the leadership and the chairman or the president of ICC. And they used to meet simply to sort of arrange bilateral series and tours and some social chit-chat. That's what used to happen till 1993. In 1993, the ICC consciously took a decision to take its affairs into its own hands, to become the governing body of the sport for all cricket around the world. And that is what was the mandate in 1993. Certainly, it was there till about 2008 and 2009. Since then, certainly in the last 4 or 5 years, a couple of my countries, England, India, and Australia, decided that that's not what they wanted. They didn't want to be under the control of a governing body. They simply wanted ICC to do what they were told, and they've converted it effectively into a members club, which is very unfortunate. You cannot develop a global sport. It's probably the second most viewed sport on television to this level. You're bringing it down. You're undermining the game around the world by doing this.
The World Cup has been reduced as well, and there's been a much bigger focus now on 2020 cricket instead of one-day cricket. Do you think that's a mistake, or is that probably where we should...
No, it's a terrible mistake. You know, you've got to look at, say, what FIFA's done with the way they've spread the game around the world. The last Football World Cup in Brazil had 32 countries taking part. And there were countries there like the United States, who till, you know, not that long ago had no culture or history of soccer on an organized basis in the United States. I think it was in about 90s that FIFA took a World Cup into America. The consequence of that was that people started playing football in the United States. In the last World Cup, the U.S. did reasonably well in its performance, but from a commercial point of view, it was an outstanding success. 20 million people watched every U.S. game played in the World Cup from the United States. That transforms into millions and millions of dollars for FIFA. So they have the vision. Rugby, which has a very similar history and structure to cricket in terms of their league teams, have decided to host the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. That's leadership and vision for me. Cricket is looking inwards. You cannot improve the quality of the associate member countries by restricting them to play the 20-over game. They're not going to improve by that. They have to play the longer formats of the game if they're going to get better. So cutting the number of teams in the World Cup in future is a step backward.
Isan mentioned about rugby and football hosting their World Cups in more developing and emerging markets. And we see with cricket over the next 10 years, all the major international tournaments are in the big three, England, India and Australia. Do you think that there's a possibility that they should look to maybe put a World 2020 into an Ireland or a Scotland, something like that?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, it's wrong that these three have carved out all the major ICC events among themselves. when an ICC event is held in any country, and in my time, Bangladesh was one of the countries that hosted, not even a World Cup, an under-19 event, the Bangladesh government put huge amount of money into the infrastructure in Bangladesh. They built 6 new international cricket grounds, which are there forever, once they're built. That's the sort of investment that is attracted when an international event is held in a country. If you want to globalize the game, spread the game, even commercialize it, you have to look externally and look forward and look outside the full member countries who have to fit international events in their own busy programs and possibly at the cost of their own domestic cricket.
On a similar note about formats, where do the Associated Nations fit into Test cricket? Is that something they should be pursuing, or is it something they should already be playing?
Look, there's much been made by the ICC when they did their reforms last year of enabling the associates to break the glass ceiling. To my mind, what they're proposing is utter nonsense. If a country like Ireland does well, and I'll take Ireland as a good example, yes, it gets the right to play the lower two ranked ICC members, Zimbabwe and the West Indies or Pakistan, whoever might be in the lower ranks. But they're not being given the resources. I mean, Ireland, if you're lucky, will get $2.5 million a year from the ICC. That is not going to sustain cricket in Ireland. Countries that emerge and start playing cricket at the highest level will need $8-10 million a year. Otherwise, they cannot professionalize the game. They cannot keep their players. Ireland will become, which is what it is today, a nursery for English cricket. Anyone who's any good will go and play for England because the financial benefits are substantially more to do that. To sustain the game at the associate level and to improve the quality of their cricket for the top associates, you've also got to give them quality cricket. England plays just one-day match in Ireland every 2 years. That's the only commitment that the ECB has to Ireland. You cannot improve Ireland's cricket by giving them so little good cricket. Countries at the highest associate level have to be guaranteed a cricket against the top teams, whether it's Australia, India, Pakistan, West Indies. They all have to make a commitment to play against the top associates if they're serious about improving the quality of cricket with the associate member countries and helping them to become test-playing nations.
Is bilateral cricket a barrier to this in the sense that it's all organised around bilateral tours instead of something with more context?
Yeah, look, during my time and for many years afterwards, there was an obligation on every country to play every other country at least once home and once away in a four-year cycle. The formats were left a little bit to them, but at least there was a fair opportunity for every country to play against each other. The minute you remove that and you put in bilateral, there's a real risk you'll bring corruption into the game. Because the countries that have high values for the host countries are then held hostage to some of these countries where unless you support them at the ICC in the voting structures and so on, they will not play you. It's simple as that. It's been happening. I don't see this thing lightly. I think it's a very, very dangerous way to go.
That's a good lead into a question. Haroon Lookout made the point at the end of his tenure that the problem at the ICC level was not necessarily the BCCI, but the fact that the other four members allowed them to push them around, and because they used that method of promising tours to divide them amongst themselves. Is this a case of divided they fall, united they stand, and why don't they unite together?
So it's very sad what happened. I had a similar issue during my time when India came and told me, as ICC president, that they would only take part in the World Cup and no other ICC event. I challenged India on that. I got England, Australia, Pakistan, West Indies and South Africa together, and the collective message they were given was that either you conform to what the ICC requires or you will be on your own. no country, whether it's India, no matter how much money they have, they can't play with themselves. They have to have opposition. So if England and Australia in recent years had been firmer with India and said, no, we are part of a larger cricket community, we are part of a larger cricket family, and you have to conform to the rules, then this would never have happened. What happened instead was they saw an opportunity to benefit themselves by joining hands with India. So these three countries, get disproportionately more money than is fair for them to receive.
Collectively pooling television rights is something that the ECB in particular and the BCCI are very strongly against, obviously because they make a lot of money and they would be the ones losing out. But is that something that even the smaller seven could do to offset this idea that the BCCI can give certain tours to certain countries?
Look, let me just explain to you this fallacy that in the ICC events, somehow in India or Australia or ECB are sacrificing television. This is nonsense. Indian broadcasters buy cricket because their public is mad about cricket. So the more cricket they show on their sports channel, the higher the viewership, the bigger the advertising, the more their subscribers. This is the reason why you get Indian broadcasters paying for non-India matches. They pay Cricket Australia $200 million over a four-year cycle. They pay ECB just over $200 million for a five-year cycle. They buy rights from Pakistan. They buy rights from South Africa because their subscribers want to watch cricket. It's not only about England and India. It's about what the viewership wants. That's the economic forces, the market forces that drives cricket in India. BCCI or ECB have no role in ICC events when it comes to that. Yes, when India plays, obviously the viewership will be higher in India, and when England plays, the viewership will be higher in England. But somehow this spin that's been given that they generate most of the revenues from the ICC can be challenged very easily. What is sad is when they came up with these formulas, of how they would share, they were not prepared to discuss it. They were not prepared for a professional independent firm to look at it from, an external firm to look at it and to assess whether there was any merit in their arguments, because frankly, there isn't.
I was actually also thinking about the external to ICC events, so the bilateral tours as well. Is there a case for, say, South Africa and Pakistan and Sri Lanka to have a collective pool of television rights for their home games as well?
Look, each one of them does very well on their own. That is not the issue. If these three countries had stuck together, there's no way the ICC would have been able to change the way its revenues are shared. If India pulled out, yes, the revenues of ICC would have come down substantially. But I can guarantee you the Indian public would not allow BCCI to pull out of ICC events on its own. I suspect that if India had pulled out, the revenues of ICC might have come down by about 40%. But if South Africa, Pakistan, Sri Lanka and West Indies got together and refused to play in ICC events, it would have even a bigger impact.
Can the ICC be fixed from where it's come now? What would you like to see to get better governance out of the ICC?
Look, it's all very simple. It's been spelled out to them in a great deal of detail by Lord Wolf. He, at the request of the ICC, he carried out a governance review. He made about 70-odd recommendations. Among this was that the ICC board should be independent of its member countries. The chair is that's a starting point. You get independent directors who are acting in the interest of the game as a whole rather than for the vested interests of the members who attend the meetings. The revenue sharing formula that Lord Wolf suggested was that money should go to countries that require it most, not countries who have the most money. That's a huge difference. That's what FIFA does. It spends a huge amount on development. The Olympic movement does that. It spreads the money around the world. So revenue sharing was another thing. The independence of the board was very important. And all these things can be done very easily and very quickly if there is a will. And if there isn't this huge conflict of interest that exists on the ICC board at the moment.
Isan, you just mentioned the Olympic movement there. The ICC recently rejected, sort of out of hand, the applying for cricket's inclusion in the Olympics. Do you think that's a mistake?
That's a huge mistake. The reason that England gave was that it clashed with their cricket season, so it would never be acceptable. What England is forgetting is that there are 95 associate and affiliate member countries who would benefit substantially by ICC being a member of the IOC movement. They would get funding, they would get participation opportunities in the Olympics. So what's been happening is that two countries, India, who does not want to be under the IOC for any of its activities, and England, because it conflicts with their domestic season, are not going to allow this to happen. When I was ICC president, the Chinese approached me to become a member of the ICC. And I had extensive talks with them, and I was trying to understand what is it that they required from the ICC. And they told me that they required assistance in establishing the game in China, because they didn't have the coaches, they didn't have the culture of cricket. They told me that their goal was to make cricket Olympic sport, and once it became an Olympic sport, they said their government would pour in a huge amount of funding into cricket in China. And that is the same with all countries. You know, once you become a member of the IOC and you become a member, you know, have the opportunity to participate in the Olympics, your own governments of the, you know, these countries would support the game hugely. So ICC is missing out, or at least 95 countries are missing out on the opportunity of a large amount of extra funding, which is being denied to them by the self-interest of a few member countries.
Isan, you mentioned a couple of times US cricket and how important that is as a market. Yes. But dating back really to when you were the ICC president, it's been a huge potential, but just basket case governance. What should the ICC do in this situation where it's not been doing what it should do?
Yeah, this is a challenge that I was faced with, and before me, my predecessors. But the fact is, you know, the United States has such enormous potential. There are over 1,000 clubs who play every week. They play cricket in the United States. There are over 25,000 active cricketers in the United States. That's more than most associate countries put, in fact, almost all the associate member countries put together. And this is not something new. Cricket in the United States started about 278 years ago. I mean, that's, you know, in the 1730s. And as late as 1840, you had a U.S.-Canada game and over 10,000 spectators attended the match. The potential is there. FIFA showed the world how to do it by actually staging a world-class event in the United States, which has just taken soccer to a different level in the U.S. What is lacking in the United States is their own leadership. The ICC should get involved in that. They should, but the ICC should also be prepared to put $20 or $30 million a year into the U.S. for the next 5 or 6 years to build up infrastructure, to spread the game. And it would earn, if it was to capture just 2 or 3% of the U.S. television market revenues, it would earn billions of dollars a year, which would pale into significance what England or India or Australia contribute to the ICC coffers. But again, as I say, that the leadership at the ICC has to have the vision to be able to do this.
Do the big three want that? Sometimes I get the sense that they prefer to be the leaders and not to develop these other countries that might undermine them because the ICC is a bigger body.
Well, I think it's summed it up by them saying that it should be a members club. I think that sums it up very neatly for them, where they're coming from.
Looking forward, what do you think, based on the lessons of the past 10 years, the past 20 years, the future for associate cricket is, and where do you, what would you like to see it happening, and what do you think will happen?
Look, what's going to happen is some of the associates, the sort of half a dozen or a dozen of the top countries, should be doing well over the next 20 years because they will get a disproportionately more funding. But whether they are able to improve enough to be able to challenge the lower place best countries, I have my doubts because they're not going to get A, resources, and secondly, enough cricket. But by denying cricket to a lot of this more junior countries, the ICC is missing out on huge potential financial benefits, as well as taking the game globally across the world. So there are going to be a lot of challenges for cricket to survive in some countries. The ICC is already cutting back on the participation of some of the associate members in some of its events worldwide. So all of that's going to affect the future of cricket in these countries.
Even in the major test nations, and particularly India, cricket's obviously operating in a global marketplace these days for sport, and it's got the EPL and the NBA and competitors like that. Are they going to become a threat to cricket in its established markets?
No, they shouldn't do. I think IPL's played an enormous role in attracting, in fact, 2020 all over the world, and in England, certainly in Australia too. It played an enormous role in getting people who would not traditionally watch the longer format of the game to get interested in the game, which is a good thing. One hopes that that is the first stepping stone into these very people looking at the longer formats of the game, the 50-over game, the test match. So it can be used as an incredibly good development tool. And certainly, you know, the 2020 format would be great for China, it would be great for the United States, it would be a great way to sort of bring cricket into the Olympics. So it has this role. I don't think it would have an impact on the other forms of the game, provided the leadership knew you know, what they were doing. What is worrying at the moment is that a lot of lip service is being paid to test cricket, the sanctity of test cricket, and preserving the game. When you look around, the reality is somewhat different. Sri Lanka came to England last year, they played just two test matches. They drew the series one each. So that was indecisive. New Zealand this year and England did the same. They won one test, England won one, only a two test match series. England went to the West Indies earlier this year and Australia there now, just two test matches each. That's not the way to preserve test cricket and to protect the game at the highest level. You've got to have a series of at least three test matches. But because England, Australia and India have crammed their cricket season so much to accommodate people who supported them in their quest for power, that they just don't have the time to play with the longer format of the game against all countries.
Do you think a lot of this comes down to just short-term thinking that, you know, let's get the most amount of money in the least amount of time rather than any sort of long-term plans for future stability?
I think it's perhaps not been done so blatantly and callously, but that's effectively the effect of this. What is going to happen, and this is a big danger, is that the stronger countries are going to get stronger because they're going to get more money, their players get paid well. You're beginning to see the cracks of this coming into world cricket now. The West Indies players pulled out of their tour from India last year over a pay dispute. Unprecedented in the history of cricket that a tour is disrupted and the players walk out of a country. You're getting the West Indies players, because they're not getting paid as much as the Indians or the Australians or the English players, are preferring to play in the IPL rather than play for the West Indies. That is a danger sign, and that's where there's weak leadership in the ICC to make sure these things don't happen. There must be a mechanism to make sure that players play for their countries first. It is, after all, the countries that produce the players. They invest heavily in the players, They are the ones who make them into heroes and role models. And then to lose them simply because there's not enough money in the game in their country is a really unfortunate thing to happen.
And at associate level, is it possible, would we ever see, say, 20 test associate nations? Is that even a feasibility?
Not in the current setup. I just don't see even another 4 or 5 coming through in the next 20 years. Not the way the cricket is structured at the moment.
And is it possible to structure it so it would, or is this something that we'll be talking about in another decade?
Yes, of course it is. But then you've got to remove these barriers of a full member of the ICC and an associate members. All members should be members. They should be playing test cricket based on purely on merit and performance. Why not have more test member countries? Because that's the only way you're going to improve cricket in the long term.
I certainly agree with that. I think I suppose the final question we'd want to talk about is there was an incident, shall we say, at the Wisden dinner earlier this year regarding yourself and Giles Clarke, who didn't take too kindly to some of the things you said. Can you give us your side of that story?
But there wasn't a side to my story. I gave a speech in which I highlighted the state of world cricket at the moment. And I said that there were challenges. There were a number of full member countries that were severely challenged, either because they didn't have enough money, or secondly because they were not getting enough opportunity to play good cricket. And I sort of told them, mentioned the impact on the West Indies, which I just told you. Then I went on to say that top countries like Ireland were simply not getting enough resources. Cricket needed vision. It needed to follow the example of soccer and rugby. And I expressed my concerns about the future of Test cricket if it continued the way it is. Mr. Clarke got very upset for some reason because he felt that they were making a huge amount of effort to protect Test cricket by putting up a test fund. I didn't engage in any discussion with him. He came and he ranted at me for a few minutes till he realized that he was the only person in a room of about 150 people who had a view which didn't agree with what I had said. So he left in a huff. Unfortunate. I would love to sit with him and debate these points with him when he had calmed down, but he walked out, unfortunately.
Ethan, just on that last point, is the ICC open to these types of debates? I feel sometimes that everything is closed off, it's not transparent.
No, they're not. I mean, when these proposals were being put up to give control to these three countries, I know for a fact that at least three member countries, and they told me this, said, we need to sit and debate this. And they were told very simply, there's nothing to discuss. Either you take it or you leave it. If you leave it, you don't accept what you're doing, you're out of the loop, you're not going to get anything from us. The countries who were wavering, and there were a couple of them, were made huge amount of promises how these three countries would play more cricket with them, they would sort of bring them to the high table, they would look after them, which in a way was dishonesty. And that's how this whole thing was done. So there's very little debate on vision and strategy. If you look at the ICC's strategic plan today and you go and compare it to what it was 7 or 8 years ago, you'll see huge difference. The strategy today is to really not look after the interests of the members as a whole.
You mentioned they said sort of take it or leave it. Can you ever foresee a time when the smaller full members and the bigger associates do say, well, leave it and break away and set up a rival organisation?
It's dangerously close to that, I think. Once the full impact of what was proposed is only now about to be rolled out. And when some of the associate member countries find that they are much worse off, when some of the full member countries find that, they haven't had a fair deal, there is a risk, and there's a risk that as, an entrepreneur or someone with bags of money will come along and come up with an alternative which these countries may find too hard to resist.
And Finally, at a personal level, are you still actively involved in the ICC? Would you like to be?
Like to be?
Yes.
No, you know, look, I did my time. I served as ICC president for 3 years. I was asked to actually stay on another year, and I declined. Because I felt that, you know, you've made your contribution, you move on, and hopefully people come along who bring better ideas and take the game forward. It's sad to see that the game has been pulled back the way it has. But I think I've played my role. I'm always there to help countries, and a few of the associate boards and full member boards do turn to me for advice and help from time to time, and that's always there. I'm always prepared to do that because for nothing more than my love for the game. But you really need to now professionalize the running of the ICC. It's a different time. It needs professionals to run the sport, not novices who seem to be involved for whatever reason in cricket in their own countries. And because of that, they are able to sit at the high table at the ICC.
Well, hopefully we'll see that better governance in the future. And thank you very much for your time, Mason.
Thank you.
There was a bit of news, Andrew, that we forgot to touch on in our last episode, which was the proposal put forward that Ireland and Scotland might be involved in the county championship, and it might be expanded from currently 18 teams to 21 and have 3 divisions of 7. I can see, and I've actually advocated something like this in the past, but not quite in this format. You're not quite so in favour though.
No, I take the arguments that it would be very beneficial for the players taking part. They'd really learn a lot about playing first class cricket, which obviously Ireland want to be doing. It would really help with their development. But Ireland moved away from county cricket a few years ago with the intention of becoming we want to be seen as an international team, not a glorified county side. I think this would be a step backwards. Even if it is branded as an Ireland A side, it still would be seen, I think, as a backward step. I think it would be a backward step. You know, the Ireland need to be branching out as their own team. I wouldn't mind too much, perhaps, one of the Irish provincial sides taking part in county cricket, or indeed all three. You know, you do see, a lot of sports where you have teams from other countries in the leagues of others. You have it in Australia in rugby league and in soccer, and we have it here in rugby league. It was a team from France in the English Super League and so on and so forth. You know, it's commonplace in North America with US and Canada, and that I wouldn't mind if a domestic team from Ireland taking part in county cricket, but an actual Irish representative side, even if it is an A side, an under 23 side, a development side, I think that's a step back.
I agree with that. I think in a development side would undermine the idea that it's a competitive side within the county program. You ultimately want them to be promoted and then to be playing in Division 1 and them to be part of that division structure. I think with regards to the county game, it doesn't make actually any sense to have 21 teams. You end up with groups of divisions of 7 that requires the same number of weeks as the divisions of 8 would. You may as well play 24 teams and have 3 divisions of 8, which would make perfect sense, and then a 2014 one-day cup and 2020 cup, or whatever they want to do with the 2020 competition. And in that situation where you had 6 extra teams, it'd be easier then to have, say, 3 Irish provincial teams and 2 Scottish provincial teams, and then one other team, perhaps a European team or what have you, which would be great for associate cricket, I think. It would, because they'd all be in Division 3 to start with, it wouldn't matter that their standard was a bit lower for the part, and they could even potentially play 3-day cricket in that division and be not necessarily fully professional, but semi-professional. And it would give them that pathway to promote those sides up into the higher echelons of county cricket if they were good enough. But I can't see 3 teams where you potentially had an Irish team and a Dutch team and a Scottish team really working for the reasons you say. It just undermines the idea that Scottish cricket and the Irish cricket are their own entities.
Yeah, they've done a lot to make themselves be you know, independent. You only need to go back just over 20 years when they were independent. They were governed by the Test and County Cricket Board, you know, the predecessor of the ECB, and you know, they've done a lot to make themselves independent. I think Ireland have perhaps been a little bit more successful than Scotland have at doing that. But yeah, to rejoin county cricket, I think it undermines a lot of the work they've done to create that separate identity.
It's probably worth pointing out too, I think it's actually in the best interests of English cricket to look at having an expansive league in that sense, to be the only league of any consequence on the European continent, rather than potentially having Ireland, Scotland creating their own league that is a rival to them. So this could work both ways. It could be very good if they worked it out properly, but you fear to the idea that they just try and tack on something just to suit English cricket.
We want something that's going to be a win-win for all sides, and I think the one that's been proposed is it's a win for perhaps for English cricket to some extent, but I don't think it is for Irish or even Scottish cricket.
Speaking of expansion of leagues into associate nations, the Caribbean Premier League has mooted the idea that they might look at having a team in Florida. I think this has come up before, but they seem to be pushing for it now that they've got a reasonably successful league up and running in the future.
A lot of it depends on how this is done. If they just go in and market to the expat community, it's not going to do anything to help cricket in the US. If a team is put in there and then they get involved with the local community there, they organise training camps for kids to get involved with your schools in the area, then that's going to help. But just putting a team there and expecting cricket to develop, that's not going to work.
Yeah, you'd hopefully see them. It depends, I guess, on how the Caribbean Premier League itself develops and whether it becomes a vehicle for developing players and sourcing talent, or whether it's going to be just a franchise operation that pulls in talent for a few weeks and doesn't have those broader roots. And I think with any of these T20 leagues, you really do hope that it does the former, because it would be much more valuable if it did so.
And again, it comes down to what we talk a lot about on this podcast, the long-term versus short-term planning. And if they want to plan long-term for the sustainability of a team in Florida, then they'd have to do the former and help develop the game locally. But if it's just short-term, make some money, then that's not going to really be a good thing.
Credit, though, to Caribbean Premier League. We mentioned before that they would be looking at some associate players that might get picked up and under their development contracts, and a few of them have been picked up, including Stephen Taylor and a few players from Canada and Bermuda. So hopefully they'll get a game. It will be interesting to see if they do. Probably they won't. But again, a bit like with Legacy Arca being on the books of the Melbourne Renegades, it is good that they'll have the opportunity to train with really high-class players.
Yeah, and with high-class coaches as well. A lot of, especially in the Americas now, the teams have moved out of the high-performance program. They're not being as exposed to the quality coaching that they perhaps were in the past, and so I think that'll be more beneficial to them as well.
And fairly short on news this week, but we'll have a big preview of the World 2020 qualifiers next week. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ, as always.